Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. All eyes are on the economy, watching oil prices, grocery costs, and inflation. And add to that, worldly events, namely a war in Iran. Nobody is watching it closer than the Federal Reserve, the body responsible for setting interest rates that affect everything from mortgages to car loans to business borrowing. And the recent Fed meeting saw the most dissent since 1992. Members kept interest rates steady, but divisions emerged. Among the dissenting faction, the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, Beth N. M. Hammack, who joins us today. The Cleveland Fed is one of 12 regional reserve banks in the Federal Reserve system, and we're going to learn more about that today. Welcome to All Sides, President Hammack.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
So there's a lot going on with the economy. The Fed met recently and decided to hold interest rates steady. All right. So, and a new Fed chair could signal a changing of the guard. So there's a lot to talk about, right, with the Fed. So let's just jump in. So this April meeting, the Fed held interest rates steady for the third consecutive policy meeting, and you were listed as one of the dissenters. Now, my understanding is you supported holding the rate steady, right?
I did. Yeah.
But what did you disagree with?
So this takes a bit of a Fed secret decoder ring to figure it out. It's a little bit wonky. It's technical. When we make the decision on interest rates, we also release a statement which has some language that gives our overall assessment of the economy, how we think about the balance of risks. And in there, there's some language that essentially means that signals that we're more likely to cut as our next move rather than leave things unchanged or leave it open-ended, that it could go either way. Based on what I see right now, I see a lot of uncertainty in the economic outlook. And uncertainty in the economic outlook, to me, translates to uncertainty in policy. And so I think our statement should have a pretty neutral stance about whether the next move is down or up or just on hold for a really long period of time, which, by the way, is my baseline.
Okay. So are those statements normally pretty benign? Was this statement unusual? Is that why you dissented?
This has been in our statement for the past couple of meetings. It's been in there since December, which was the last time that we reduced interest rates. Mm. I think at that point in time, we wanted to take a pause and get more information about how the economy was performing. But since then, there's been a lot of changes in the economic outlook. The conflict in Iran is certainly having an impact. It's having an impact on energy prices. It's having an impact on gasoline prices, as all of your listeners will know. When you go to the gas station, everyone's feeling that in their wallets, that increase in prices. And so, to me, I'm a little worried about how that's going to play out over the next period of time. Mm-hmm. And so, it's important to spend some time unpacking what that conflict could mean. When prices are high, that impacts everyday Americans. It impacts their ability to spend. It impacts their ability to afford repairs. So we talk with individuals. When I'm out in the district, I try to talk to individuals about their experiences. And we sat down with a group of workers when I was in Cincinnati a few months back, and they were talking about that $400 emergency fund that they have and how that fund just doesn't stretch the way it used to. Mm-hmm. It used to be able to cover their auto repair. Now it can't quite cover that. That's costing them $500 or $600. And so what that means is that this spending that's helped to keep economic growth so solid in the U.S. could be in jeopardy because these higher prices might mean that individuals can't spend the way they could. And then that could impact employment. So as you may know, at the Federal Reserve, we have two mandates that we've been given by Congress. One is to ensure maximum employment, which means that anybody who wants a job can find a job, and price stability, which means that prices are going up, but they're going up at a very slow rate. So we have to balance both sides of that. This conflict in Iran can impact both sides of that mandate. And so to me right now, I think we need to be a little bit more neutral about how things are going to play out and what that might mean for interest rates.
Okay, so this disagreement that happened, though, my understanding is that a dissent of any kind is unusual at a Fed meeting. I saw one article that said that it hasn't happened much. Maybe it hasn't happened since 1992, so like 30 years. So Did you have any pause before you decided to disagree or say you didn't agree with the statement?
Well, one of the things I love about the FOMC is it's a room of 19 individuals who come from all different walks of life, all different backgrounds. You've got people who are academics, you've got business people in the room, you've got community leaders in the room, and everyone brings a completely unique perspective. As you would hope, we're all doing our best for the American public. Our goal when we walk in that room is to be focused on the data, the stories that I hear out in the district, to really make sure that we're steering the economy towards those two sides of our mandate as best we can. And so smart people at times can disagree. We try to agreeably disagree. We haven't had this many dissents since 1992. I think that's the right year. But there are from time to time disagreements. And what I would say is, even though there were four, and so it sounds like on a headline level that there was a lot of disagreement, there was a lot more agreement than disagreement in the room.
That post-meeting statement, though, who was it for? Like, I know you always issue statements, but since you disagreed with it, like, who do you think it was written for? Was it for the president? Was it for the average person? Like, why did they write it the way they did?
We write it for the public. We're trying to signal some amount of where we're headed. So it's important to monetary policy works well when people understand what we call our reaction function. That means people understand that if news changes, if the economy changes, they understand how we're going to think about that, how we're going to approach that, and what that means for interest rates. We want the everyday American to know, are interest rates going up or down? We want business leaders to know, do we think interest rates are going up or down? Because that helps them to plan their business, and that helps them to think about where we're headed. So right now, the statement that we put is that interest rates were on hold, but we have this signal in there that it's more likely that the next move will be a move down. I thought that was a little bit misleading, just given my view of where the economy is, but you know, eight other people on the committee disagreed with me. And so that's, we're a Democratic body. And so the majority wins.
Okay. So do you think interest rates should stay the same? Like whenever the meeting happens again and they talk about interest rates, if you were the sole decider?
Well, I walk into every meeting with an open mind. Our next meeting is not until the middle of June. My outlook right now is that interest rates will be on hold for quite some time. I think we have pressures coming on both sides of our mandate. What I see is on that maximum employment side, it does look to me like we've got low and stable unemployment. The unemployment rate's about 4.3% writ large across the country. When I'm out in the district in Ohio, what I hear a lot from businesses is that it's hard for them to find the labor they want. I was just out to dinner last night at a Thai restaurant outside of Cleveland, and they have a notice saying that they will no longer take walk-ins because they can't find the staff to service the restaurant. And so you're seeing these signals places where there's availability of jobs. It may not be the jobs that everybody wants, but it does feel like we're in a bit of an equilibrium. It feels like, you know, we're in this low hire, low fire environment, which to some people, you know, could signal fragility in the labor market. But it's been pretty stable over the past 6 months at that 4.3% unemployment. So that side of our mandate, I give us a pretty good grade. I think we're doing pretty well. On the inflation side, we've been missing our 2% objective for the past 5 years. And with the pressures that we see right now coming from the conflict in Iran, it could mean that those pricing pressures are going to be more persistent. The work that we've done at the Center for Inflation Research, which we run out of the Cleveland Fed, will show that gas prices in particular are really impactful for individuals. It really impacts people when they see how much money is being spent on the gas bill. It forces when they go to the supermarket, it forces them to think twice about, can I buy the name brand or do I have to trade down? Again, when we were out talking with individuals in Columbus a month or so back, they were talking about how they've been trading down. When they go to the supermarket, they used to buy steak and then they switch to ground beef, and now they're switching to pasta and beans. And so these types of trade-offs are really having an impact on everyday people, and that matters.
I would think that most everyday people, though, if they were to say to you what they want, if they're planning to buy a car or planning to buy a house, they wish the interest rate was lower. And they don't really care what happens to the whole rest of the economy, even though they should. And I understand that. And you're going to say they should. But they don't really, they want the interest rates lower. It's too high. It's been too high for too long. I can't afford a house. I can't afford a car. And I need those things.
Well, they might want interest rates lower, but lower interest rates often will mean that prices will get driven higher. And so it's that balancing
act. But people don't know that. Do they know that?
Well, they know it when they go out and try to spend their money and they see that they're able to get less. The inflation that we've had over the past 5 years has given us 10 years worth of 2% inflation. So think about it this way. If you used to go to the supermarket and spend $100 to fill up your grocery cart, if inflation had been 2%, it would only cost you $110 now.
Okay.
In actuality, it's costing you like $120, $121, given the inflation that we've experienced.
Yes, it is. I'm going to say, yeah, I mean, I haven't spent just $100 at the grocery store probably in like 25 years. So,
right.
Yeah. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about interest rates, inflation, and the economy with the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, Beth Hammack. I wanted to pivot to change coming at the Fed. There's change coming at the top. Jerome Powell has served as chair since 2018. He has withstood aggressive political pressure from the White House, coming from President Trump, and Powell's term as chair is coming to an end. But in a break with tradition, he announced he's going to stay on the Board of Governors. He wants to see an investigation into the cost of renovations of the Federal Reserve building. He wants to see that through. What's your take on him staying? Is that a steadying thing, or is it a lightning rod because he and President Trump argue so much?
The Federal Reserve is a body that tries to be as independent and apolitical as anybody out there. There can be times when it's difficult and others can try to bring you into that political conversation. Mm-hmm. But my job and all the jobs of the other FOMC members when we walk in that room is to be solely focused on the data that we're seeing and the stories that we're hearing from people around the district to understand what that means for the economy and to help set monetary policy so we can fill both sides of that mandate and make sure that the economy continues to work well for all Americans. That's the ultimate goal. And so
do you care that Jerome Powell is staying, or does it matter to you that if he stays or if he goes?
So his term as chair does mm-hmm. end on May 15th. His governorship goes until January of 2028, so he can stay mm-hmm. for that longer period of time. He's done, in my opinion, a phenomenal job. Mm-hmm. I think he's really an unbelievable patriot who's tried to really understand what's going on in the economy, to really understand how it impacts everyday people, and to really find balance in terms of how we're approaching policy. I'm excited for the new chair who's coming in, Kevin Warsh. I think mm-hmm. he'll bring different insights and different perspectives, and I think that's really healthy for us to have a broad set of discussion and debate. And, you know, as I talked about, having 19 different perspectives in the room is really valuable to me because I learned so much, mm-hmm. particularly from the people who have very different backgrounds. So one of the people who I learned the most from is one of the academics on the committee who grew up in the analysis. I grew up in markets. He grew up in academia. Mm. And we have really interesting discussions because we just approach the problems from such different angles.
So you mentioned Kevin Warsh. He's poised to become the next chair. That's contingent on a Senate hearing and a vote whenever that happens. But Warsh has talked about how the Fed should be, quote, strictly independent in making monetary policy. But he added that he's willing to work with Congress and the Trump administration on, quote, non-monetary matters. What do you take that to mean?
I think what it means is that the monetary policy aspect of what we do is really sacred. It's really of the highest order importance to every member of the public, and we have to make sure that we're doing that in a way where we're free from short-term political pressures, where we can really think about the medium-term and longer-term impacts. So like you said, everyday Americans might look at us and say, my gosh, I really want a lower interest rate mm-hmm. so I can buy a car or buy a house. But they may not understand those second-order impacts of that could mean that the cost of the car or the cost of the house mm-hmm. is more expensive. And so we have to balance some of those factors as we're thinking about policy. On the other hand, there are a lot of other things that we do. We supervise and regulate the banks, right? The Federal Reserve, we talk about monetary policy all the yeah. time, but we have four other functions in terms of what we do. And so it's in those other things that I think the incoming chair is thinking about. Do those need to be quite as independent? Supervision and regulation, we set some of that at the Federal Reserve. We work in partnership with the FDIC, the OCC, other Washington agencies who are not independent. They're directed by the president and by Congress. And so are those areas where we should be mindful of what's going on. And so I think mm-hmm. those are the parts where he's talking about less, you know, more coordination with Treasury and other areas.
In one of the hearings where Warsh was talking, he said he wanted, quote, messier interest rate setting meetings. And then he also used the phrase, I want a good family fight, which he said could lead to better economic decisions. So, I mean, I guess that would mean that he liked, you know, that four people dissented at the last meeting. He wants a good family fight. What do you take all that to mean? Do you think there should be more debate at these meetings?
Well, there is a lot of debate at these meetings. You can actually go and read the transcripts of our conversations. Mm. They're released on a 5-year delay. And I think what you'll find if you're willing to read through all 250 pages of the meeting
oh, no.
Conversation. You'll see that there is a lot of disagreement. Yeah. There's a lot of different perspectives that are brought to bear. And so it is a really robust conversation. I grew up in a family of five. I've got two sisters. We had a lot of family fights, but they were always from a place of love. It's from a place of having the same goals, the same values, the same endpoint. But it didn't mean that we didn't get down into it and really go at each other one, you know, now and again. And so to me, that's what a family fight means. It means that you have a similar set of objectives and goals that you're trying to pursue, but you may have different approaches of what you think the right thing to do is. And at the end of the day, you need to come to consensus, to come to resolution, and make a decision that's in the benefit of the American people.
How much would you say that the war in Iran is impacting the economy right now? I mean, you know, is it putting a thumb on the scale when it comes to inflation? Is it going to just get worse before it gets better because of Iran?
What I'm watching closely with this conflict in Iran is how long is it going to continue? We've been going now for 9 weeks, I think. And the question is really, how much longer is it going to persist? Typically, when you have these types of one-off shocks, you want to look through them. You want to recognize that they tend to be short-lived. But what I worry about right now is that we've been missing on the inflation side of our mandate for 5 years. Mm. And when you have one of these shocks, which is, this is probably the fourth shock that we've had in 5 years. So think about the COVID pandemic and the supply chains. You had the Russia-Ukraine invasion that created one of these short-term shocks. Tariffs, supposed to be a one-time shock. Now we have the fourth one in 5 years. Is each one of these really independent? Is each one of these going to be short-lived? Or is this starting to build in consumers' and businesses' minds to create more of an inflationary mindset? We talk a lot about inflation expectations at the Fed. Mm-hmm. And right now, what I see is that inflation expectations are pretty well anchored around that 2% goal. But if that starts to move away, then that could mean that inflation's becoming more embedded in the economy. And that makes our job as monetary policymakers much more difficult. Now, as inflation stays high, as we talked about, it could start to impact the demand side of the equation as well. And if businesses see that demand for their products isn't as strong, that could mean that they're going to pull back in hiring. And so that starts to hit the other side of that mandate, that full employment side. So it could be that right now it looks to me like everybody who wants a job largely can find a job. But if you see that demand side coming, getting under pressure, then that could be in jeopardy on that side of our mandate. And so to me, right now, there's a lot of uncertainty, and mm-hmm. I think uncertainty in that economic outlook should translate into uncertainty in our policy in terms of which way we need to move for interest rates. Right now, my base case is that we'll be on hold for quite some time around this level, which is pretty close to what I think of as kind of the natural rate of interest.
Okay. And when you say quite some time, people are going to ask what that means.
Because they do. They ask me that and a lot.
So what do you answer? What is quite some time? I mean, are we talking years or are we talking months?
It depends how the economy unfolds. Mm-hmm. I can't put a hard number on it because I don't know how things are going to unfold. But based on my outlook right now, I think it could be a good while.
Mm. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland's role here in Ohio. And we're going to talk more with President and CEO Beth Hammack. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The economy is front of mind for most Ohioans as they fill up their gas tank, buy groceries, and watch headlines about national and world events, including the war in Iran. Nobody is watching these economic developments closer than the Federal Reserve, the body responsible for setting interest rates that impact everything from mortgages to car loans to business borrowing. The Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland is one of 12 regional reserve banks in the Federal Reserve System, and we're going to learn more about that today. Still with us in the studio, we have President and CEO Beth Hammack. Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, great to be here, Amy.
So I understand you have a busy day. You're here in Columbus. Can you tell me about what's on your agenda? Who are you talking to? Why this trip from Cleveland down to Columbus?
Yeah, a big part of the job is really understanding what's going on in the economy. And so, of course, we've got the national statistics. We've got the employment data that the BLS releases, which will come out tomorrow morning. We've got inflation data that comes from official sources. But what I find is that when we're at these moments of uncertainty in the economy, by going out and talking to individual business, I get a really good sense of where the economy is headed. I hear about the trade-offs that each of those business owners is thinking about hiring people, raising prices, reducing prices, whatever that might be. That gives me a good sense of what their outlook is, which tells me not just where the economy is today, but where it's going to be headed in 6 or 12 months. And we often talk that monetary policy works with long and variable lags, which means it just takes a long time for the decisions we make to have impact on individuals. And so having those conversations with business leaders gives me good insights. So when we're here today, I'm going to be participating in the Ohio Business Roundtable this afternoon. Mm-hmm. So meeting with a bunch of business leaders there. And then tomorrow we'll be touring a manufacturing plant and then meeting one-on-one with another company to get their perspective on what's going on. I try to go all around the district, and our district covers all of Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Kentucky, and just the very northern panhandle, think Wheeling, West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
That's the fourth district. And so I try to go out and about in the district periodically. I think we've got 4 different trips this month. The last time that I was down here in Columbus, we got to visit some of Ohio State. We got to see the Center for Automotive Research there and really understand what they're doing. And that was a great visit because I got both a center of how we're developing the workforce of tomorrow. So I got to meet with 2 students, Gabriel and Joe, who were working on the battery challenge that they're running.
Mm-hmm.
They're helping to design new EV batteries.
A better battery.
Better battery.
I think we've had them on the show before to talk about that. I mean, they do great work there.
They do fantastic work. And what was really exciting to see was that Gabriel, who was, I believe, a grad student at Ohio State, he was able to secure a job through his work in this program. He'd gotten so much in terms of training and development that car companies wanted to hire him out of the gate before he'd even graduated. He was partnered with another student from Columbus State, Joe, who had been working in a battery technician. He'd been a service technician. And part of what they're doing in designing these batteries is thinking about not just what's going to make the car more efficient, but is it going to be easy for the technicians to service those ongoing? And so it's seeing these types of innovations around the district that's really powerful for me to understand how are we developing the workforce of the future? What is that going to mean in terms of the skills that people need? What's it going to mean in terms of product availability, some of the productivity and growth for the economy overall?
It's interesting that you mentioned going to the Ohio Business Roundtable, talking about the workers of tomorrow, because our organization, WOSU, is doing this month-long series called Reshaping Work. And we're talking, literally, we're doing a series on who are the workers of tomorrow and trying to make that prediction. And I had the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services director on, and they have this, like, top jobs list, right? The most in-demand jobs. And what's actually the most in-demand jobs in Ohio are home healthcare workers and truck drivers, which I found so interesting. I mean, what does that say to you about the economy that these two jobs, because home healthcare workers are one of the lowest paying jobs there is, and that those are the most in-demand jobs in Ohio. That's where we need the most people. What it, like, when you go to the Ohio Business Roundtable later, I don't know if that'll come up, but like, what does that mean to you when you think about Ohio's economy?
Well, there's a lot going on in Ohio. One of the things that I love about the 4th District is we're really a microcosm of the country. We've got a pretty good representation of most of the industries that are happening. We've got tremendous innovation, as we talked about. We've got the shift from manufacturing to services, but we're still the second most manufacturing intensive district of the 12 Federal Reserve districts in the country. We've got energy production going on. We've got eds and meds. And so you've got a little bit of everything happening here that's happening around the country. And so it's a really good viewpoint of what's going on. One of the things that we see broadly, and Columbus feels a little bit less than the rest of the district, is the demographic shift in the population, right? People are getting older. We're not having as many births. And so you're seeing that aging. That's part of what's keeping this demand for home health care workers at an elevated level. What I also hear when I'm out in the districts a lot is I hear about the demand for construction workers. We were at a roundtable in Akron and meeting with a home builder. And they were talking, you know, I would hire 7 people tomorrow if I could find them, but it's hard to find them. So what I hear a lot in the district is that we need more of that manual labor. We need more of those skilled technicians. And we just haven't been creating as many of those individuals in this economy.
You started in your role as the president and CEO of the Cleveland Fed in August of 2024, but we read an interview that said that you had an aha moment in 2019 that kind of set you on this path. Is this a job you thought you would have?
It's not a job I thought I would have when I was a kid, for sure.
Yeah.
I'd spent 30 years working on Wall Street and finance, and I had what was really a wonderful career. And as part of that, I had the opportunity to work with policymakers. I sat on a couple different committees for different government bodies, one for the Treasury, called the Treasury Department, called the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, and one for the New York Fed, called the New York's Market Practices Group, Treasury Market Practices Group. And by interacting with policymakers, I got to learn about how they thought about the world, how they thought about what was happening in the markets, how they thought about what was happening in the broad economy. And there was this really wonky thing that happened in 2019, which is in this super niche corner of the markets called the repo markets. But it's a place where almost nothing ever happens. It's usually pretty sleepy. Mm-hmm. But you had this couple of days where the Fed was running down its balance sheet and the repo markets moved by 500 basis points in a day. And it was this moment when the policymaker said, we don't understand, how could that possibly happen? There's all these efficient market hypotheses. If you see these types of opportunities come up, traders at banks should be stepping in to help bridge this gap. And so we'd had a meeting scheduled of one of those committees where I was down talking to the Board of Governors. And they said, can you come in a little bit early and tell us about what happened? How could this go on for a couple of days? What drives that? And for me, that was a moment where I realized that I had some knowledge from having worked inside the bank, but understanding how the policymakers thought, there was a differentiated perspective. I could take that kind of common sense view and marry it with the theoretical and explain to them why things maybe don't work quite as smoothly as they would think about. Mm. And so to me, that was the aha moment where I'm like, you know, maybe at one point down the road, there could be a use for someone like me sitting in one of these rooms to help set policy.
You were in Columbus a few months ago in February to talk to Ohio State students, and a part of that discussion was to explain the role of the Federal Reserve and to offer some career guidance. Tell me about this outreach. I mean, whenever you sat there in front of all those college students, did they have any clue, you know, what the Federal Reserve does or like how it will impact their future as they head into the working world?
Well, it's funny. It's not just Ohio State students. I said I was on Wall Street for 30 years, and I have friends who are still on Wall Street who only think that the Fed does monetary policy. But we do so much more. We have five functions that we think about when we're operating. One is monetary policy, and that's a really important one because, of course, setting interest rates is a primary goal. But we have four other key functions. One is financial stability. So we look across the landscape to see, is the economy working smoothly? Are financial markets working as we expect them to? If they don't, we have emergency facilities. Think in the pandemic or in 2023 and the banking stress. We can put different facilities in place to help smooth the markets and make sure that the economy continues to work for everyone.
Okay.
Our third function is supervising and regulating the banks. So we've got a team of 300 examiners who are out across the district, across Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky, talking to those banks to make sure that the banks are operating as they should, because having a strong banking system is really the foundation of having a strong economy. Mm-hmm. Our fourth function is running the nation's payment system. So that can be electronic payments like the FedWire. If you've ever needed to transfer money to buy a house, we operate that
you
system,
that?
The FedWire.
Okay.
The other thing that we do that maybe hits home is we have 28 facilities across the country where we're processing cash bills, that those paper bills in your wallet. We call those Federal Reserve notes.
Wait, paper money?
Paper money.
Okay.
Paper money.
Who has that anymore?
A lot of people have it. And
no,
actually, people need it, particularly when you think about in the pandemic, there was actually an increase in the demand for money. And a few years back, there was that horrible power outage in Puerto Rico. And we shipped lots of extra money into Puerto Rico in that time so that people could have access to cash. Because if you don't have cash money in your wallet and there's a power outage, how are you going to buy bread and eggs and butter at the supermarket?
Okay.
So that's really...
Do you regulate how much paper money is printed? Do you guys, are you in...
We do that in concert with the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. Okay. We look for what the demand is.
Were you a part of the decision to get rid of the penny?
We were not. That was Treasury's decision.
Okay.
We do facilitate the movement of pennies, but we're responsible for paper currency, not coin.
Oh.
As it turns out.
Fascinating. Okay.
And then our last function is consumer protection and community development. So really looking across the landscape as to what's working or what's not working in terms of trends that are happening, helping to work with local areas and figure out where things are going. So when I was down in Cincinnati not long ago, we met with a group called the Brighton Center. And it's an interesting model. There's something similar happening up in Cleveland. It's one of these wraparound service center models where it's looking at people at the lower income, lower and middle income part of the population, trying to help them they're Brighton Center is really focused on workforce development, workforce training. They do a lot of training around home health care workers. They do some around technology as well. But they also are trying to partner with other organizations around, if you're coming in here because you don't have a job, maybe you also don't have somewhere to live. Maybe you don't have good access to healthy, nutritious foods. Maybe you don't have daycare. And so they're trying to wrap all of these services together so that you can create a one-stop shop for people as they're trying to get their lives back in order and really participate in the economy and move up to that next round.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the economy and the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland with the president and CEO of that bank, Beth Hammack. Before we run out of time, I did want to ask you a couple of questions, I guess, about the because one of your duties you mentioned, you supervise and regulate banks in Ohio and all the banks, right? How are banks in Ohio doing? Like, we have a lot of them here. We have a few. We're headquartered here. Yeah. How are banks doing?
Banks are doing really well right now. What I see is a strong, healthy banking system. Banks are continuing to make loans. They're continuing to support the economy by giving funds to individuals and businesses so they can continue to grow. And that's really
despite healthy thing. The interest rate that they have to charge or that they do charge.
Well, when you step back and think about where interest rates are today, I mean, I grew up in the markets in the 90s, and interest rates were routinely between 3% and 6% in the 90s. So we did come out of a period where you had 0% interest rates for almost 15 years.
Yeah, that was
and so
great.
A lot of people have that in their mind. But I think when we step back and look in the broader lens of history, I think that 15 years of 0% interest rates is probably going to be the anomaly. It was great for borrowers. It was not so great for savers. So think about if you're at the higher, if you're at the older.
I must have been a borrower right at that time because I just, you know,
that's yes. where it is.
Yeah,
but if you're living on a fixed income, if you're an older individual who's living on a fixed income, actually having higher interest rates is better for you than lower interest rates because you're probably not borrowing. You probably have savings and you want to be earning more on that. So it's really the balance of the two.
You spoke in March about the strength of the U.S. dollar, noting that it is the world's most dominant currency. What do you think is the strength of the U.S. dollar right now? Because, I mean, we hear about the U.S. economy. I mean, everything is in turmoil right now with oil and gas and the war in Iran. So how is the U.S. dollar doing?
The U.S. dollar continues to be the dominant currency. And there's a lot of benefits for the world, not just for Americans, but for the world, and having one currency that everyone agrees on is what things are going to be denominated in. So think about oil prices. You think of oil prices in dollar terms. You think of gold prices in dollar terms. Even new types of currencies like cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, are quoted in dollar terms. That makes it easier for everyone the world around, businesses, individuals, to think about and compare pricing because it's all denominated in the same unit.
I never thought about that. Cryptocurrency is always set in dollar terms. Okay, continue.
No, when you think about money, you think about money has three main purposes. One is a store of value, and the U.S. dollar is still a really great store of value. So if you put your money in it, you're pretty confident that you're going to get the same amount back out. Now, of course, inflation is there, and that's why part of our job is so important to make sure that we keep inflation at these low and stable numbers. The second role of currency is to be a medium of exchange. So can you use it to buy something? Like when you go to the supermarket, can you get butter and eggs in exchange for those paper bills that you bring in? Right now, we're not really seeing cryptocurrency being used in that type of a way, right? So I don't really think of it as being a medium exchange. And then that third one is a unit of account, right? Is it something that you talk about the price of other things in terms of? And so right now, the U.S. dollar really meets all three of those criterion. It is far and away, I think, the most in demand of currencies. There are a couple of others out there. I talked in March about maybe the euro could be one day that could challenge the U.S. dollar. But right now, you don't have the depth of market of investable products. You don't have the confidence in the rule of law like you have in the U.S. and a lot of other currencies. And so that is what's helping to keep the U.S. dollar in that dominant position.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. We have run out of time with you, and you have a busy day. But we have been talking about interest rates, inflation, the economy, and more with the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, Beth Hammack. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy. This was great.
Coming up, we're going to get a local perspective from an economist with Nationwide. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Juravich. Whether you're following the news or just checking the receipt at your grocery store, the economy is hard to ignore right now. The Federal Reserve is the main group keeping tabs on all of this, making big calls on interest rates that determine how much we pay for everything from houses to cars. But also keeping tabs on everything from housing stock to gas prices to the war in Iran are local economists. And we're going to talk about how things are looking here in Central Ohio with senior economist with Nationwide, Ben Ayers. Welcome back to the show, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to some of the comments that Beth Hammack, the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, just made. Do you have any response or reaction to what you heard from her?
Well, first of all, she did a great job in just articulating the complicated situation that the Fed is facing right now. As she said, they have this dual mandate of, you know, fostering maximum employment, but also trying to push for stable prices. And clearly there's some division among the members of the FOMC as far as which direction we should go with monetary policy, especially in response to the spike in energy costs that we've seen over the past 2 months and the upper pressure that puts on inflation. I think she articulated very well the stance of what we would call the more hawkish wing of the Fed that believes that, you know, the employment market is in pretty good shape. We don't need to do a lot to support that. We need to focus more on the pressure that people are feeling from inflation. Mm-hmm. And because of that, not needing to change rates for quite some time was the language that she used. But
I know she wouldn't tell me what quite some time
Well,
means.
She can't do that. And, and that's understandable given, you know, how things can shift so much. We've just seen that over the past couple of months. You know, I think coming into the year, most people, including most people at the Fed, thought, yeah, there should be an easing bias, and we probably are going to lower
rates. But
no one
had a war with Iran on their bingo cards.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And so that has changed the situation, and everyone's just kind of adapting to that, and the Fed is in that camp as well.
So the Fed decided to hold interest rates steady. There was that dissent that we talked about in the previous segment about, you know, from a fraction of the Fed. And President Hammack was one of the dissenters just on the statement that came out afterward. And she basically indicated that she wants to keep interest rates steady, you know, for an unknown period of time. From your perspective as the senior economist of Nationwide, what were you hoping the Fed will do, like at their next meeting or the meeting after that? Do you have an opinion?
You know, I think they're going to continue to keep rates steady. Mm-hmm. I think there's just too much uncertainty out there. And, you know, as she said very well, there's a lot of people on this committee. There's 12 voting members of the FOMC, and it's going to be very difficult to reach a full consensus around what to do on policy. And there's just too much unknown as far as where inflation is going to crop up over the next 3 to 6 months. You know, we're all watching the news right now to see if this ceasefire holds, if we have an agreement, if things start to unwind on the energy price front. But as we've seen already, it could pop back up again here just over the next week or two. So I think there's too much uncertainty to really move on rates right now. They're at a pretty solid policy position. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a relatively neutral stance where they're not really actively supporting the economy too much, but they're not actively working against things. So I'm expecting them to keep rates steady here for at least the next couple of meetings.
Do you think we have to get used to, she kind of mentioned getting used to a new normal. She talked about how we're not going to see zero interest rates again, that we should consider that the anomaly, not where we are right now. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. You know, that was certainly something we've never seen before, and it's created some disruptions for the economy here, you know, a decade and a half later or so. And I don't think they want to go back to that. I think something around a, you know, 3% interest rate on the shorter end of the yield curve, that makes a lot of sense from a longer term perspective. Obviously, the Fed needs to be flexible to what happens with conditions and lower that, you know, at least temporarily, potentially in response to some weakness in the economy. But I think she's right that something around a more moderate interest rate like we have now is probably something we should be growing accustomed to in the more longer term.
Before we zero in on Ohio, I want to get your take on the new developments of Kevin Warsh probably is going to be confirmed as the next Fed chair. I've read stories where former Fed governors have raised some concerns about some of the things he's saying, but then other stories say that he's going to bring a fresh approach and everything's going to be great. So what are your thoughts there?
You know, I do think Kevin Warsh is highly qualified. He's been on the Fed before. He's been through some of those battles. He, you know, has seen a lot of things and the impacts that the Fed can have on the economy. So he's well prepared for the role. I do think he's coming in at a very complicated time. And I think he has a bias towards lowering interest rates, and that's going to be the push that he has coming in. But he's going to face, again, this hawkish wing of the Fed that says, no, we don't want to lower interest rates for a while because of the concerns we have about inflation. And I think it is going to be hard for him to create that consensus around lowering interest rates again. And so we don't see the Fed lowering rates till probably towards the end of the year. And even that is that question depending on how long the conflict goes on and how long we see those energy prices at very high levels.
How much sway does the Fed and the Fed chair have when it comes to the economy? Because I feel like there's a lot of pressure coming from the Trump administration, too. So, but the Fed chair is supposed to be an independent body. There was this dissent. I mean, what do you think is going to happen here? How much sway do they have?
I mean, the Fed and the Fed chair have a lot of sway mm-hmm. on the economy. You know, the signals that they give as far as what direction they're going with policy really impact decisions that we as consumers or businesses make. I think the tough part, and I think that actually outgoing Fed Chair Powell has outlined this very well, is it runs in very long lags. You know, so an interest rate move that the Fed makes now, you might not really feel that for a year or a year and a half down the road. And it really is those successive moves by the Fed that really make a difference. Just because, you know, say they lower rates 25 basis points, just because your mortgage rate is 25 basis points lower, that's not going to make things meaningfully more affordable for people who can't afford a home right now. It's more, oh, they lowered rates 1 or 2% over the course of a year or two that really makes a difference. So it's a lot of complicated factors in there, but certainly, you know, one of the key things we watch for where the economy is going to go, what trajectory we're going to see, and obviously if it's working in tandem with the federal government and other actors that are supporting the economy too.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the local economy with Ben Ayers, senior economist with Nationwide. Now, when I think of Nationwide, I think insurance, right?
Sure.
And maybe real estate from time to time. But what's your role with Nationwide? What does a Nationwide economist do?
Sure. I mean, we're there basically to advise the leaders of Nationwide about the economy and give them up to date on key trends. We're in charge of really analyzing everything that's going on, say for right now, with the conflict in the Middle East and what impact that's having on inflation, on demand for cars, demand for homes, interest rates, the Fed. We're just there to make sure we guide the leaders of Nationwide to make the best decisions for our members and clients about what's going on in the economy.
Let's talk about Ohio business a little bit. What are you hearing? What's going on with workers and hiring, and how are things going? How's the economy from your perspective here?
You know, it's muddling along, I guess, is the way I would phrase it. Kind of like we're seeing a little bit at the national economy. We're not seeing strong growth, but we're not seeing signs that the economy, and particularly here in Ohio, is falling off the table. It's kind of a wait and see approach from many businesses. You know, it's been a volatile year and a half. Last year was all of the policy changes, particularly on the tariff front, and many businesses said, okay, we can adjust with that, but maybe we're not going to make a big investment or make a big hiring spree because we're trying to wade through this and see where things go. And I think there was some optimism coming into 2026 that more Ohio businesses would say, okay, 2026, that's the year to expand, that's the year to build things out, and now we have to layer in, you know, the war and the conflict and the increase in energy prices there. And I think that's shifted many businesses back to a wait and see approach as we look out here for at least the near term, because I think much of that resources and money that many businesses said, yeah, maybe I'll make a big purchase or make a big hire. Well, now it's going to energy costs and now it's going to increase costs for production. And I go, okay, now we're going to delay those expansion plans maybe a little bit further into 2026 than we had at the beginning of the year.
Mm. What about March's job growth data? Was it better than expected?
It was better. Yeah, we did see some pretty good growth at Ohio, you know, particularly from, you know, construction. So kind of a ramp up into the spring selling season around here, people trying to build those homes.
But there's like a lag in the numbers, so we might not see that because now that the war in Iran is not going away. Is that what you mean?
Is our concern.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the upcoming numbers, I think many businesses might pull back the reins a little bit here in the second quarter. Again, I hope for this is not a longer term thing, that when we get to the second half of the year that we're going to see improved job numbers, going to see improved growth. But I think in the near term, again, many businesses are just kind of sitting steady and kind of riding this out and not seeing a big change in their operations, but also not making a big investment.
What do you see the impact of something like the fact that everyone is, you know, has a stake in the midterm elections in November? So everyone wants the economy to look good for them by November, because it doesn't matter. The day after the election doesn't matter. But the day before, what the economy looks like that day is going to indicate who votes for what. So how do you think that's going to play into it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that is a swing factor for things this year. You know, everyone's trying to look good ahead of the elections, and you know, some of that is different changes in policy. I think the problem there is most of the policy changes we might make right now wouldn't really have much of an impact between now in November. And so we're
But it would just
more,
be news headlines, and that's what people pay attention to.
So certainly there are some initiatives to try to push through some more stimulus. But, you know, all of that certainly right now being overwhelmed by the concerns about energy prices and gasoline prices for many consumers, because, you know, they're seeing their dollar not go as far. And that's probably still the dominant theme we're hearing out in the field right now.
Yeah. Tell me more about gas prices and how that's going to play into your economic outlook. I mean, how does this play out beyond the gas pump? Because, I mean, if it costs, you know, we're nearing it's costing so much more to fill the tank. So what happens then? Yeah.
Well, you know, basically it just cuts down on the amount of money that people have to spend on other items. Mm-hmm. And so we're already hearing about cuts in what we would call discretionary spending. So you have some optionality there from a spending standpoint. I mean, people are looking at the summer and going, well, maybe I won't take a big vacation because I'm worried about where gas prices are. Maybe I won't, you know, make a big purchase of a car or a home because I'm worried about the affordability standpoint. But that's really the focus just on the gas prices. I think there's another factor we have to keep in mind here that, you know, transportation costs are going up a lot. And so we have diesel fuel prices for trucking are $5.50, $6 a gallon across the country. And that pushes up potentially the cost for all of the items we face. Obviously, everything we buy, from food to items when we go to the store for toiletries or whatever, all is transported in some way across the country. And as those costs go up, that starts to bleed into the upward pressure on inflation for other everyday items. And I think that's when you hear, you know, President Hammack talk about concerns about inflation. That's a little bit the second stage there where they're worried, yeah, not just the gas prices, but how much does this bleed through into the costs everywhere else that we might face as consumers?
Yeah, I guess I should have asked her this instead of you, but I'm going to ask you because you're here now. are there worries that inflation is going to get worse? Because everyone's trying to get back to that 2%. But if we've been steady at the 3-ish area for a while, what if it gets worse?
I mean, I think it definitely is going to get worse in the very near term. You know, for the next 2 months or so, especially when you look at the April data that we'll get and then probably the May data as well, depending on what happens with gas prices here over the next couple of weeks, you know, we're going to see that inflation rate go above 4%, at least temporarily. And I think even by the end of the year, we're still probably be above 3%. So in that 3 to 3.5% range. And, you know, I still think we're on a path eventually to get back to 2 to 2.5% for inflation. But as she laid out very well, this is just another bump in the road that pushes that further out into the future. We're probably not going to get there till sometime in 2027. And that's assuming that something else doesn't pop up that pushes up inflation, just like we've seen in recent years.
What was the highest it was like a few years ago?
It was almost up to 10%.
Oh, that's, yeah, I was trying to remember how short my memory is.
So we're not seeing anywhere close to that level. Okay. And that's the good news. But, you know, we've been hoping to get back to those lower levels of inflation. And this is just one more thing that's preventing that from happening.
When you talk about 10%, 3 sounds great, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right? It's all perspective.
It's all perspective. I think I kind of asked her this, if like we should just accept that 3 is the new normal, but do we really need to be at 2? Like, who says?
I mean, that's kind of the long-term goal that the Fed has set.
Yeah.
And I've gone through several rounds of looking at that and asking whether that is the right number. They just did that very recently over the last year or two. You know, I think there is some talk that maybe they need to push that up to 2.5% because
and just be happy with that.
Just be happy with that.
Yeah.
And just say there's a lot of underlying things that continue to push up cost and maybe won't ultimately get down to 2%. But, you know, I do think they worry if you jump it from 2 to 3, you know, that's a much higher price path for people. And many people, when they look out and they think about 10, 20 years from now, especially if you're in retirement or planning for retirement, it puts a lot of extra pressure on the cash you need to save up. And I think they'd rather keep it down to that 2 to 2.5% range if they can.
Well, and I've never paid more attention to like those cost of living increases that you get, you know, with your job here and there. People have been paying attention to that more recently, because when inflation was at 10% and your cost of living increase is 2 or 3%, then you're like, wait a second here. Right. And so is that something, if the Fed can agree that 2.5 is the new normal, What would that do for these cost of living adjustments that people get?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that would change expectations
for
what you would expect to get from a wage perspective. I think what you're talking about is what we would call real incomes. So it's not just the level of any money we get in, it's adjusted for inflation.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, as you said, look back a couple of years ago, most people's real incomes were negative.
Yeah.
It's only been within the past year or two where we've seen real incomes turn to positive again, where those wage gains are outpacing the inflation rate. And I think if you are expecting that inflation is going to be higher over a longer term period, yeah, you're going to expect to pay more for wages. And that kind of feeds the whole inflationary cycle. And that's why they really want to get it as low as possible from that inflationary expectation perspective.
So we have less than 2 minutes left, but I just wanted to get your take. You know, we have inflation, we have food costs, gas prices. What do you think is going to account for the overall resilience here? How's Ohio going to do? What, you know, give me a, be optimistic for a moment.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the optimism is around the business sector, I think, and some of the incentives that are out there for businesses to expand. You know, there were a lot of great potential incentives on the tax front for businesses within the One Big Beautiful Bill. Mm-hmm. And we remain optimistic that we're going to see more activity, more investment because of that. And some of that is manufacturing, and that comes back to a state like Ohio. And we're still optimistic that's going to happen. I guess, again, I think it's been a bit delayed by the recent disruptions in the market and the geopolitics. And we're expecting things to kick back in the second half of the year, but you know, it just hasn't happened quite yet.
We've been talking about economics and the local economy with Ben Ayers, senior economist for Nationwide. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And earlier in the hour, we talked about the economy, interest rates, and inflation, and the Fed with the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, Beth Hammack. So if you missed any part of today's show, be sure to listen back, WOSU.org/allsides. You can subscribe to our podcast, and every episode is available for free in the WOSU mobile app. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.